Beginning with 2 Samuel chapter 13, we enter a 4 or 5 chapter haul of just total dysfunction. In fact, it's really some bizarre stories pertaining to David and his family. And as you're working your way through, as you're studying these chapters, as you're looking for insights and nuggets, and Lord, why is this here? And what are you trying to communicate? It's very, very easy. In fact, I've struggled with these chapters. But there's a key to understanding them. And this might sound a little counterintuitive, but I think you'll know what I mean. The way that you can understand these stories, from the terrible actions of Amnon, David's firstborn, raping his sister Tamar, to Absalom seeking vengeance, ultimately killing his brother via the inactions of his father, to him fleeing into exile. The stories we'll be looking at this morning. The key to understanding them, and I'm convinced of this, is to realize, to keep in mind, to emphasize, who is the main character of the story. Now, on the surface, it might seem as though Absalom is, but Absalom is not the main character. In fact, Absalom, his brothers, the family, these are all secondary. Case in point, when you get to Chronicles, which is God's reflections of this time period, Absalom and his rebellion are not mentioned. Amnon, his terrible deed, avoided. None of these things are recorded in God's recollections years later of this time period. The way that you can understand these stories is to understand that the stories are about David. In fact, the text sets this up for us. In chapter 12, following Nathan's confrontation of David regarding his adultery with Bathsheba and then the murder of her husband Uriah, within this confronting, Nathan the prophet rebuking David, calling him to account, we have a section of scripture that is important. Verse 10 of chapter 12, Nathan the prophet, after calling him to account, he says, "Now therefore," which is prophetic, "this is the consequence, this is the result, this is what's going to manifest in your life, David, because of the decisions that you've made. Now therefore, as a result of your deeds," note, "the sword shall never depart from your house, because you despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes. I will give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it in secretly, but I will do these things before all of Israel." So you have here David being called to account because of his deplorable sin. Sin in which there was no offering, no sacrifice could atone. God would forgive. God would cast his sin as far as the east is to the west. God would take care of his sin positionally. Consequentially, there would be repercussions. And the repercussions are clear. They're articulated. They're made known. Now, that sets the context for why then you get to chapter 13. Immediately following, we get this story of Amnon. "The sword, David, will never depart from your house. Adversaries will rise up within your house. Because of your decisions, your house is going to be a train wreck." In fact, even earlier in the chapter, in the little parable that Nathan had given David of the lamb, David had taken a lamb, Bathsheba, and God would call to account a fourfold recompense. David would lose 4 children because of his sin. First, the child born to he and Bathsheba. Then we saw Amnon, the heir to the throne, also dying by the sword, by his own brother. There would be consequences. So understand, we have these chapters, we have these stories, we have Absalom. Why? Because it's about David. Let me share why I think this is important. Here's been my big struggle. Every Bible teacher that you hear teach on these passages are really hard on Absalom. I mean, really hard. I mean, Absalom is a villain. He's evil. My struggle is David's the villain. Like, I have struggled working my way through the text because while everybody I've listened to tells me Absalom is so wicked and evil, I find myself very sympathetic with Absalom in so many ways. And it's a struggle because Absalom will meet a tragic end. And you're like, is Absalom this bad of a guy? What's the deal? Why the stories? The tragedy of Absalom is that Absalom has a tragic end. Why? Because of the sins of his father, David. And as we work our way through, keep in mind that the main character, the emphasis, why these stories are given to us is what it tells us about David, because David is the main character. Now, Absalom, his sister comes home. She's torn, battered, emotional. She's upset. Absalom recognizes something has gone terribly wrong. He asks her, was it your brother? And she acknowledges. And Absalom says nothing. We're told that David finds out and he's angry. But 2 years pass. David is outraged over the behavior of Amnon, but David does nothing to defend his daughter, to put his son back into place. He is completely inactive. He's angry about it, righteously so, but he does nothing. And to Absalom's credit, does Absalom react? Listen, if you treated my sister that way, I'm showing up at your door immediately. We're going to have a problem. Absalom knows he's not the king. He knows there's a pecking order. Absalom chills out. For 2 years he waits. And then it becomes clear that David is not going to do anything. So Absalom, it's the sheep shearing time of the year, which was akin to like kind of throwing a party like they would with the harvest. He invites his dad, his brothers. David doesn't go, but Amnon attends. Absalom sets up a scheme where they get Amnon drunk, and then they whack him. He's murdered. Word gets back to David. Initially, it's a false report that all of David's sons have been killed by Absalom. That was not true. It was just the one that was guilty, the one that was deserving. Absalom realizing, hey, I have a problem here. I've taken matters into my own hands. He flees to a small kingdom known as Geshur. It was his grandfather was the king. His mom had been the daughter of the king, had married David. This is Absalom's genealogy. Absalom goes back to his hometown, and he camps out there. For 3 years, chapter 13 closes with verse 38. For 3 years, Absalom had fled, stayed in Geshur, and King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. So David longs for Absalom. He doesn't go to Absalom. We find ourselves in a very odd place, a riff, a tension. In some regards, why would David not go for Absalom? First, I mean, Absalom had taken matters into his own hands, but do you think also there might have been a compulsion of guilt within David? That Absalom had acted in his inaction? That David's inaction, David's unwillingness to deal with Amnon had forced Absalom to finally do something to defend the honor of his sister? David longs for Absalom, but David doesn't go to Absalom. So 2 years, Absalom waits. He finally deals with Amnon because David wouldn't. Now he goes to Geshur, and he's in Geshur for 3 years, crickets from David. Nothing. It has now been 5 years since the original rape has happened. And then we get to chapter 14, verse 1. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and again, Joab has been a common character. He is the commander of David's armies. He's number two in charge. He's also David's nephew. Zeruiah was David's sister. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. So Joab is watching all of this. Keep in mind also, by the way, that with the death of Amnon, Absalom now becomes heir to the throne and traditional succession. There was a son between the two of them. He is not mentioned anywhere other than the genealogies, leading most scholars to believe that he probably passed away at a young age. Absalom now, because of the death of Amnon, is heir to the throne. David is concerned with what's going on. He's concerned with his family. He's concerned with the kingdom. He's concerned with succession. He's longing for his son, but won't do anything about it. Joab perceives this. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman. We don't know her name. She's just the wise woman from Tekoa. And Joab said to her, please pretend to be a mourner and put on some mourning apparel and do not anoint yourself with oil, but act like a woman who has been mourning a long time for the dead. And go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Joab's going to be setting this thing up. So Joab put words in her mouth, and when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground, prostrated herself, and said, help, O king. So she's coming, asking David for help. She's got the attire of mourning, grief. She's asking David for help. This is all a ruse set up by Joab. So the king said to her, what troubles you? And she answered, indeed, I am a widow. My husband is dead. Now your maidservant had two sons, and the two fought with each other in the field. And there was no one to part them, but the one struck the other and killed him. I mean, we need a good ruse. Let's go back to Cain and Abel. Now the whole family has risen up against your maidservant, and they have said, deliver him who struck his brother, that we may execute him for the life of his brother whom he killed, and we will destroy the heir also. So they would extinguish my ember that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the earth. So the woman from Tekoa comes to David. She says, this has been a terrible thing that's befallen me. My husband has died. I'm a widow. I have two sons. Now, in that culture, a widow was her care was left to the sons. So the sons would provide, this was the social safety net. If your husband died, if you had a son, he would become your defender, protector, provider, etc. So she's got two sons. She's in a good spot. But then another tragedy happens. They're out in a field, and they're chit-chatting. A contention arises. They get into a fight. One rises up and kills the other. Nobody's disputing the facts. It was murder. And the family now wants the murderer held to justice. So they're appealing to the law. The law says murder, found guilty, executed. But the widow, she's got a problem now. Because if she now only has one son, yes, he's guilty of murder, but she's coming to the king saying, if they take my son and they execute him, though I know he's guilty, now I'm in a real tough spot because I have no one to defend and protect and to care for me. So she's coming to David seeking some type of a concession, some type of mercy. She wants the life of her son spared. So the king said to the woman, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you. And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, my lord, O king, let the iniquity be on me and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless. So the king says, whoever says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall not touch you anymore. And so David says, it's granted, clemency, I'm going to give your son a pardon, he's protected. If anyone comes and challenges, you bring it to me. I'm the final arbitrator of such things. This is my ruling. It's final. Go your way. All good. You can see how this is going to play itself out now. Then she says, please let the king remember the Lord your God and do not permit the avenger of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. So he says, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Therefore, the woman said, please let your maidservant speak another word to my lord the king. So David said, say on. So the woman said, why then have you schemed such a thing against the people of God? Ruh-roh, For the king speaks this thing as one who is guilty, and that the king does not bring his banished one home again. So what she's saying is, she's saying, in my situation, you saw fit for mercy, grace, forgiveness. But what about your own home? What about this dynamic with Amnon and now Absalom? And how Absalom's been in exile. And you won't extend, you'll extend forgiveness to a man you don't know, but you won't extend forgiveness, you won't seek reconciliation with your own son, your son Absalom. So what's the deal with that? The banished one. For we, she continues, verse 4, will surely die and become like water spilt on the ground, which cannot yet be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away a life, but he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. Now, therefore, I have come to speak of this thing to my lord, the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your maidservant said, I will now speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his maidservant, for the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the inheritance of God. Your maidservant said, the word of my lord the king will now be comforting, for as the angel of God, so is my lord the king in discerning good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. I mean, she lays it out. She's like, you're a good king, but what you're doing right now isn't a good thing. And in looking at a dynamic identical in someone else, you have clarity. But in regards to your own life, it's nothing but confusion. And I'm coming to you, all of Israel's trouble. And you can imagine the dynamic, right? If you're a resident of Israel, if you're part of the kingdom, Amnon was the successor. Like, David has brought in great stability through war, prosperity. The kingdom is I mean, we're cooking. Things are good. There's prosperity. But with any type of monarch, the continuation of the throne is important for the continuation of stability. So they all see Amnon as the obvious, but now one brother has killed the other brother who's the heir, now making him the heir, but he's been banished, and everyone's on a little like pins and needles. And so she's like, I've come to you, do the right thing. Call the banished one home. So the king answered, verse 18, and said to the woman, please do not hide from me anything that I ask you. The woman said, please let the Lord speak. So the king says, is the hand of Joab with you in this? So it's at this point David is like, I'm not even sure this story at all is real. Did Joab put you up to this? Like, promise you'll tell me the truth. This has like the fingerprints of good old Joab. So the woman answered and said, as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord has, the king has spoken, for your servant Joab commanded me, and he put all the words in my mouth of your maidservant, to bring about this change of affairs. Your servant Joab has done this thing, but my lord is wise, according to the wisdom of the angel of God, to know everything that is in the earth. You can imagine Joab has kind of been around the corner, eavesdropping in. Maybe he's been in the palace room standing there. And David looks over and is like, it was him, right? And she's like, yeah, kind of was. Don't take it out on Joab. Now, this is interesting to me because Joab could have gone to David himself, right? Like at any point during these 3 years, Joab could have come to David and said, listen, You long for Absalom. You need to do what's necessary to make this right. You need to bring him home. There needs to be forgiveness. There needs to be restoration. This can't go on any longer. Like, Joab could have gone to him. Says something that Joab didn't feel as though he could. And instead, he actually kind of takes a page out of whose playbook? Nathan the prophet. You know, Nathan was given word by God that David had committed adultery and had Uriah murdered. No one else knew that, but God revealed it to Nathan. Nathan could have gone toe-to-toe, said, you, that woman, and that kid, this was a result of your adultery and you had her. He could have gone mano a mano, right? But he doesn't. How does Nathan approach David? He comes with a parable. He tells him a story. He gets David emotionally invested and then makes his point. And Joel does the same thing here. Again, there's a creativity to this. It reveals something about David. David was so often blind to truth when it came to his family. He could see right and wrong elsewhere. In the lives of others, he could be a wise judge. But in his own life, when things were close to him, they got fuzzy. And so when people are trying to bring counsel, they give David a much broader perspective, and then they bring it home quickly. Joab. So the king says to Joab, "All right, I've granted this thing. Go therefore, bring back the young man Absalom." So Joab fell to the ground on his face. He bowed himself and he thanked the king. And Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord, O king, and that the king has fulfilled my request, the request of his servant." Joab gets what he wants. David does the right thing. So Joab arose and went to Geshur, and he brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, "Let him return to his own house, but do not let him see my face." So Absalom returned to his own house, but did not see the king's face. This is a terrible decision on the part of David. David acknowledges, he acquiesces to the idea that Absalom needs to come home. So he tells Joab, "Go get him." But when they get there, what happens? David's like, "He can go to his home. He can stay in his home. I don't want to see his face." So there's like this weird thing that's happening that David's like kind of forgiving, but kind of not. He's like, "Okay, I realize you need to come back, you know, because of your position. But I want it to be clear, Absalom, that as far as you and I are concerned, we're not good." Like, that's what David's articulating. Okay, Absalom needs to come back. He needs to be returned. There needs to be a measure of restoration. But as far as me and that boy goes, I don't want to see his face. Now, if you're Absalom, Joab shows up, knocks on the front door, says, "You can come home, bud. It's time. It's been 3 years." Absalom packs up his family. They move back to Jerusalem, only to then discover that he has no meeting with his dad. He has no access. He's completely cut off. Again, who's the character here? The main character is David. Is this forgiveness? No. Is this Christ-like? No. Will this have consequence? You better believe it. Now, in all Israel, there was no one, verse 25, who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. It's kind of my life verse. So Absalom, and here's the deal, Absalom looked the part. Absalom was a handsome man. He had a dynamic to him. We're told that from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, I mean, there was no blemish in him. I love this detail. This detail plays itself out later, but we're told that when he cut the hair of his head, at the end of every year, he cut it. Because it was heavy on him, when he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels according to the king's standard. So every year he got a haircut, like Chad Mosley. Right, or Aaron. So every year Absalom goes and gets a haircut, and he weighs it. Why would you weigh it to begin with? I mean, seems kind of vain. But then we're given this measurement. A little debate in regards to the measurement. Most scholars would land around 6 pounds of hair. So the man grew a mane. To Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. So keep in mind that Absalom has brought in his sister. She lives with him. She'll never be married. But then Absalom, as tribute to his sister, names a daughter after her aunt. So 3 sons, a daughter. Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. Again, our timeline. Amnon rapes Tamar. 2 years pass. Absalom finally enacts vengeance, justice. He flees to Geshur. 3 years pass. We're at 5 years from the original sin. And now David's like, you can come back. He comes back. He's got a family. He relocates. But David wants nothing to do with him. You're not going to see my face. 2 more years pass. We are now 7 years from the original deed. And again, my heart just, this is dysfunction. This is sad. I mean, it's one thing to not have a relationship with your son when he's living in Geshur. Now he's down the street and you still don't want to see him. Therefore, and note always, when you see a therefore, you ask, why is it therefore? It's there because Absalom is in isolation. 2 years spinning his wheels. Why am I here? What am I doing? What's happening? So Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king. So he calls up Joab to get some clarity. But guess what? Joab would not come to him. And when he sent again a second time, Joab would not come. So now Absalom's trying to get Joab on the phone, and Joab's ghosting Absalom. So Absalom says to his servants, you know, Joab's field is near mine, and he has barley there. He's not going to answer my calls. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Verse 31, then Joab arose and came to Absalom's house. I'll take your call now. You just set my field on fire. Absalom's like, I will get through to someone. So Joab comes and he says, why has your servant set my field on fire? What's the deal, man? But Absalom answered Joab, look, I sent to you saying, come here that I may send you to the king. Why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better for me to still be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. But if there's iniquity in me, let him execute me. And again, you can relate to Absalom. Absalom's like, I had a good life in Geshur. You show up, say the king wants to see me. I pack up my family, relocate. It's been 2 years. Crickets, nothing. And not only that, I've been trying to get in touch with you twice. And because you didn't answer, I set your field on fire. You didn't answer. Joab, what am I doing here? That's what he's saying. Either let me see the king, either let's reconcile, let's figure this out, let's move forward, or kill me. But this limbo thing is ridiculous. Now, as mentioned, don't you sympathize a lot with Absalom here? And on the flip side to it, don't you look at David and you're like, man. Like he had so discredited himself. He had so forfeited the moral high ground because of his actions. He was so debilitated, almost paralyzed by his own guilt. Even with Nathan saying, iniquity, the sword, these things are going to come to your house, David does nothing proactive. David, in some ways, plays the woe is me victim card. And it's because of that that there are repercussions. So Joab goes to the king and told him. And when he called for Absalom, he came to the king. He bowed himself to the face of his ground before the king. The king kissed Absalom. So Absalom is sent for. He comes into the palace. I want to read this again and see if you pick out the operative words. So Joab went to the king and told him. And when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Is there any father-son dynamic here whatsoever? Is there any father-son reconciliation? Is there any forgiveness? Is there any I love you? Is there any I'm so sorry that this happened? Couldn't David at this point say, you know, I should have dealt with Amnon. I'm sorry I put you into this situation. Yeah, Tamar was your sister. That's my daughter. And I should have done something, and I didn't, and that was foolish. And I understand why you did what you did. You shouldn't have done it. It was wrong. That wasn't your right, your position, your role. But let's move on. Let's move forward. But does David do any of that? Not at all. Absalom is now lighting fields on fire to get attention. So Joab's like, we need to bring him in. David brings him in. The king, the king, the king, the king. But there's no dad. After this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. You know, before we get to the continuation of what happens next, I want just very quickly jump ahead to verses 7 and 8, because there's a detail here that I think is important, especially as we try to determine Absalom's core motivations, okay? Because this is part of the deal. We're not 100% sure what's going on really in Absalom's heart. You get why he kills Amnon. We can relate, we can understand, that makes sense. What happens next, what's happening? Verse 7, so Absalom said to the king, please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. Now, what Absalom is saying right here, and again, this will be a little bit further into the story, but it's context. Absalom is saying, and he says to David, when I was in Geshur, I fled, I went into exile, I knew what I had done, and I prayed to God that if there was any way, shape, or form, if the circumstances would allow, if I was ever able to come back home, if I could come back to Jerusalem, I made a vow that if God could orchestrate those events, if I could get back home, that I would serve the Lord. That's what he says. Now, you can debate whether or not that's genuine, and that's fair. But this is the motivation that Absalom seems to provide for his actions. I told God if I got home, I was going to serve him. And guess what happened? Joab, we read the story, works things out. He's extended the invitation to come home. Now, he amasses for himself, verse 1 of 15, chariots, horses, 50 men to run before him. So he's got an entourage, a big show, not totally abnormal because he is the heir to the throne at this point. He is the son of the king. He has now been restored at least providentially to that position, whereas there's internal dynamics with his father. Absalom, we're told, verse 2, would rise early, and he would stand beside the way to the gate. The gates in ancient cities were kind of doubled as a courthouse. It was where the elders would gather. It's where you could take a case if you needed an arbitration. It's where the movers, the shakers would gather. Again, not an abnormal thing for Absalom to go to the gates. It's where the elders would sit. And so it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, what city are you from? And they would say, your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel. So Absalom would then say to him, look, your case is good, it's right. But there is no deputy of the king to hear you. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice. So what's happening here, Absalom's in line to be king. He's been restored, at least publicly, with his father, the king. He's taking his time, and he's going to the courts, the gate. People are coming to get audience with the king. Now, whether or not Absalom is twisting the truth or not, there is an interesting point to be made. Absalom's argument is like, hey, I'll hear your case. Why? Because the king has no time for you. Like, the king doesn't have anybody out here hearing cases. The king is not fulfilling his duties. But I will be king one day, so I'm here. I'm filling the role. Bring your case to me because my father, the king, isn't doing his job. Now, that would be very easy to argue against if at the same gate there were representatives from David doing their job. The indication here being that Absalom actually has somewhat of a point. Like, hey, my dad's really not doing the job of king here the way he needs to be, so I have this position. I'm here. I'm filling a role. No problem. And again, what would his motivation have been? According to his own words, God, if you get me out of Geshur, you can get me back to the land. If you have a vision, a plan, a future for me, I will do your work. This would be God's work. This was the job of a king. Again, you find yourself at all sympathizing with Absalom here? Am I the only one? Okay. I'm the only one. So it was that whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and he would take him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom acted towards all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. That's a very difficult verse. Absalom stole the hearts. Did he steal the hearts by underhanded means? Or did he steal the hearts by being admirable and noble and available and there? Regardless of how you read it, and again, if his intention is to overthrow his father, if that was the intention, then this is not a good thing. But if his intention is what he said it was later on, right? That he had come back, if God would provide a way, I'll do your work. If he's doing God's work, this is a good thing. Is Absalom earning the respect of the people? He is. He's doing a job. And at any point, couldn't David have come down? Said, no. This is my job. This is my role. This is my right. It's not your time. No, there's none of that. Absalom is just filling what seems to be a void left by David. Verse 7, now it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said to the king. Now that would really fast forward the story, if that's 40 years. There is some debate. The Septuagint, an early translation, has 40 translated as 4 years, meaning that this process took a period of about 4 years, which again, we're moving the timeline even further. If it is properly translated as 40, it's 40 years from what? And a lot of scholars would place the time period of that as being 40 years from the time that David had been called to be king. You can dig into that more on your own. But after this period passes, Absalom says to the king, please let me go to Hebron, pay the vow for which I've made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And Absalom's desire to go to Hebron, that's where he was born. It's where he grew up. It's where David's kingdom was established for 7 years before he had conquered Jerusalem. So he wants to go to Hebron, home. So David said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. Without context, that is a brutal verse to me. Why is that a brutal verse? Go in peace are the final words that David will ever say to Absalom. This is the last time Absalom will ever see his son alive. The next time he sees Absalom, he will be dead as a doornail. In the lead up to all of this, Do you think at any point in his life, David looked back to this moment and said, there was so much more I wish I had said to my son? If I had known that was the last time I'd see him. That I should have said, I love you. I understand. No. Hey, Dad, I want to go back. I want to fulfill this vow. David says, go in peace. Go, shalom. That's it. No reconciliation, no forgiveness, nothing. Painful. So Absalom then sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. Again, now Absalom's intentions are revealed. He is wanting to overthrow his father. He's wanting to take the position as king. Is he wrong in that? David been a good king? He been a good king to Absalom? Now, David, when kings were supposed to go to war, didn't. David amassed wives when he shouldn't. David committed adultery. David had an innocent man murdered. Absalom, as a young man, watches his father marry the young woman and have kids by her too. He's growing up in this dysfunction. He has seen his father when he came back to Jerusalem, bringing the ark, dancing. Absalom saw how he treated his first wife, Michal, and how he had cut her off and been heavy-handed. I mean, Absalom had watched his father. Watched his father do nothing when the oldest raped a daughter. I mean, can you at least understand how Absalom, he comes back to Jerusalem, his father has never really forgiven him. There has been no path of reconciliation. There has been no attempt at forgiveness. Absalom is next in line. Absalom has been acting as a king for 4 years. Positionally, practically. Can you at least understand that Absalom at this point decides, you know what? I don't think he should be king anymore. I can totally understand it. I can sympathize with it. The problem is he was wrong. He was right, but he was wrong. Because who makes a king? It's God. You see, the thing that does make David and Absalom very different is that David was in a very similar position as Absalom. There was a king over him named Saul. And that king was a terrible king, was a wicked king. That king didn't treat him very well, threw spears at him, forced him to run into exile. Sweet words, no meaning, no depth, constant tension, always questioning motivation. David saw Saul and thought, I'll be a better king. But David said, it's not my job to make the switch. That is only the job for God. You see, at this point, Absalom could have been absolutely right. My dad has lost his way. He's been evil. He's been wicked. He's been terrible to his family. Yeah, I get this whole religious thing, and he writes these psalms, but as a kid growing up in the home, hypocrite. I could be a better king. I should be a better king. But what Absalom missed is it wasn't his job to take a throne. For if God wanted him to be a better king, God would make that switch. So Absalom's error here isn't necessarily in how he evaluates it. His error is the fact that he then decides it's up to him to do something about it. There's no faith, there's no trust, there's no belief in the providence of God. Absalom sent spies. He's got this whole thing. He's going to go to Hebron. He's given instruction. With Absalom went 200 men who had been invited from Jerusalem. They went along innocently, not knowing anything. So he invites this great coalition of people. They have no idea what his plan is. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gileonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gilon, where he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. Absalom has a plan. He is executing the plan. But he knows he needs credibility. He knows he needs counsel. He knows he needs to recruit the right people. And we're specifically told here that he sends for an old man named Ahithophel, who 12 years earlier left Jerusalem. 12 years before that had been David's most trusted counselor, had been one of the wisest men of Israel. Ahithophel had left Jerusalem, had washed his hands of the situation, had gone back home, and had lived a simple life and wanted nothing to do with it all. Why? Because he hated David's guts. Because David had taken his granddaughter, Bathsheba, and had ruined her life. And the young man in which she had married, David had him murdered. And David, under the guise of being this great guy, had moved her into his harem. And Absalom is like, send for Ahithophel. And Ahithophel was all too keen and ready to jump into the conspiracy. So they are now moving. And they are increasing in number. What happens next? You'll have to wait. So, Father, Lord, we just leave that there.